Last time, brother, we began looking at Israel's experience in Egypt. We described it as a time of tremendous hopelessness. We described how difficult it must be to live without hope. We described how Israel was going through some very serious circumstances, and it seemed that God was not involved. And yet, we began to see that all along, all during that time, working behind the scenes, God was planning to free His people. He was setting up circumstances in such a way that He would, at the perfect time, deliver His people from the troubles that they were in. If you turn with me to Exodus chapter 3, we'll pick up where we left off last time. As we mentioned, Israel was under the gun, we might say. Literally, under the knife. When baby boys were supposed to be murdered as soon as they were born. And when that didn't work, they were supposed to be thrown into the Nile. Now, the Israelites were very productive people. God was blessing them with many, many children. And many survived these very difficult times. But the trouble and the tribulation that they were going through seemed to go on and on and on. It went from the time of Moses' birth through the first segment of his life to age 40, when he killed the Egyptian, was found out, and then fled. And then we covered the second segment of Moses' life from age 40 to 80, when he was a shepherd in Midian. And now we come to that third stage of his life and what we can learn during this period of time. Exodus chapter 3 and verse 7, we read this last time, but just to pick up so we get back into the context, the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt. Now, did God just now see that? Or is he simply stating this because now is the time for him to intervene? God was well aware of what had been going on the whole time. He says, I have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. And we expressed last time how God knows what we're going through. He may not yet choose to intervene for reasons we might not understand, but he is always faithful. Verse 8, so I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and large land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to a place of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. God is not unaware. Verse 10, come now therefore, I'll send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. So all during this time, God is working with Israel. He's working with Moses. He's working with the Egyptians. Frankly, he's working on the punishment of the Canaanites. All of this is going on in this beautiful, we might say, ballet of circumstances that's going to be to everyone's benefit in the long run. Now, in verses 16 and 17, after God identifies himself to Moses, he says to Moses, verse 16, go and gather the elders of Israel together. We've mentioned this before, that slavery in ancient Egypt was different from slavery in early America, in that there were still tribes, there were still leaders of tribes here in Egypt. So the Israelites had elders that oversaw large portions of the various tribes. So they were brought together. In America, slavery was very much a personal thing. Families were completely separated. Tribes were completely separated. In this case, tribes stayed together. So gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the eternal God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me, saying, I have surely visited you and seen what is done to you in Egypt. In other words, God is saying, I'm very well aware of what you're dealing with. Verse 17. And I have said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt, to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, a land that flows with milk and honey. So the question is, when? Now the announcement is going to be made. How much longer would it take? It'll still be a while. God's timing is perfect. It's not on our timetable. His timing is perfect. Verse 18. Then they will heed your voice, these elders. And you shall come, you and the elders of Israel, to the king of Egypt. And you shall say to him, the eternal God of the Hebrews has met with us. And now, please, let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the eternal our God. Now, God clearly said from the beginning that he would take his people into the promised land. And yet here, the only request is to go 3 days' journey into the wilderness. Have you ever wondered why? Well, if you have an answer, I'd sure appreciate knowing, because I don't. Was this simply to go sacrifice and then leave at a later time? Or was this all part of God's great plan? I would say, at least for me, until I get a better answer, I would think that God knows best. And for whatever reason, all they were requesting at first was a 3-day trip into the wilderness. Verse 19. But I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go. No, not even by a mighty hand. Now remember, Moses is being told this, and he's going to pass this on to the elders of Israel. So what should they be hearing? It's going to be a while. It's going to take a great series of miracles from God. And yet what happened after the first miracle didn't spring Israel from Egypt? Well, they got very discouraged. I'm sure the king will not let you go. Verse 20. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in its midst. And after that, he will let you go. So they were told very specifically it would be some time. Verse 21. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be when you go that you shall not go empty-handed. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor, namely of her who dwells near her house, articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing. And you shall put them on your sons and your daughters. So shall you plunder the Egyptians. And some would say, well, that's not very fair, that they're going to steal all these things from the Egyptians. But what we do have to remember is that the Israelites had worked probably 200 years for no pay. So to take a few trinkets like this certainly was only a small payment for all that Israel had done in Egypt during the time of their slavery. God lays it out in advance, but Moses, and especially the Israelites, their leadership, misses much of this instruction. They expect that they're going to be sprung from captivity very quickly. So here in chapter 4, after describing again himself and the miracles that he would be able to use to prove to the Israelite leaders that God was leading him, we come down to verse 27. The Lord said to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. So he went and met him on the mountain of God and kissed him. They had not seen each other in 40 years, maybe more. So Moses told Aaron all the words of the Eternal who had sent him and all the signs which he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words which the Eternal had spoken to Moses. Then he did the signs in the sight of the people. And so the people believed when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel, and that he had looked on their affliction, and they bowed their heads and worshipped. So the first time in a very long time, it seems that the Israelites had hope. Great hope. God announced their deliverance from oppression. Now apparently what really moved the elders of Israel were the tricks. the signs, throwing down the rod and it turns into a snake, turning water into blood, putting his hand inside of his cloak and pulling it out leprous and then sticking it back in and it comes back out completely whole. They were impressed by that. And that's what seemed to convince them that God was actually working there. Well, the interesting thing we'll see later is that false teachers can produce miracles as well. So it's not the miracles that are the proof. God expected the Israelites to have faith. And what is often the missing ingredient all during the time of the Old Covenant? It's faith that God truly loves them, that He is truly going to fulfill every promise that He has made. Faith was what was lacking. So the miracles were impressive, but as soon as things didn't turn out the way they expected, they began to blame first Moses and blame God as well. Now you ask the question at this point, why couldn't God have just removed the trouble? I mean, why couldn't have God just stopped the mistreatment? Why couldn't have God just stopped the oppression? Why did this deliverance require leaving? Leaving their homes, leaving their area of comfort, the place they had lived for a couple hundred years. Well, God wanted them totally out of Egypt. When we understand that God was working this miracle so that we today could understand that Egypt pictures sin, we don't just change our circumstances within sin. We get out of it completely. We leave it behind. So God is painting this beautiful picture with this real life experience of the Israelites that you cannot just change the circumstances and stay in sin. You have to get out of it completely. One friend recently told me that years and years ago when he came into the church as a very young adult, he had all kinds of record albums that had rather, for the time, unsavory music on them. And he remembers the day that he took all of them outside with a hammer and smashed them to bits. And he said, you know, today I probably could have sold those for thousands of dollars. But I had to get out of sin. I had to get out completely. And so that's exactly what we see here. It wasn't enough for the Israelites just to have comfort within sin. They had to get out of it completely. They had to remove themselves. They had to follow God's lead away from Egypt, away from sin. If we're not totally out of sin and we're comfortable next to it, what's going to happen? It's going to draw us back in. Old habits are hard to break. So this change of everything is what God expected of Israel. So we begin in chapter 5 then. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh exactly what they were asked. Thus says the eternal God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. Now, note that Moses never said, let us go 3 days into the wilderness, hold a feast, and then come back. You see, we'd go 3 days into the wilderness, keep the first day of unleavened bread, and then they would continue on. That was apparently the original request. Never said they would come back. Verse 2, Pharaoh said, who is Yahweh? Who is the eternal Yahweh that I should obey His voice and let Israel go? I do not know Yahweh, nor will I let Israel go. There were lots of gods that the Egyptians worshipped, but the true God was not among them. They didn't even know His name. Didn't know how to identify Him. So no, I'm not going to let the people go. So, verse 3, they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go 3 days' journey into the desert, sacrifice to the eternal our God, lest He fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. If we don't obey God, there will be trouble. Great lesson for us as well. Verse 4, then the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people from their work? Get back to your labor. And Pharaoh said, look, The people of the land are many now, and you make them rest from their labor. You got them all distracted now. Isn't it interesting? We can all ask ourselves, are we distracted by our labors? Isn't it interesting? We can be so busy working that we're distracted from what is truly important. So what is Pharaoh attempting to do? Try to get them busy. Busyness can be a real curse. Be so busy that you rest from our labors with God. So the same day, verse 6, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters, the people, and their officers, saying, "You shall no longer give the people straw to make brick as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. And you shall lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before. You shall not reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore they cry out, saying, 'Let us go and sacrifice to our God.'" What is Satan, one of Satan, again, Pharaoh picturing Satan, what is Satan, one of Satan's chief methods of distracting God's people? It's through work. Yeah, but work is a good thing. I'm making money for my family. I'm paying our bills. I'm taking care of my obligations. Work can absolutely swallow us. So if you are too busy, maybe there's some reevaluation we need to do prior to the Passover to see how we might rearrange our schedule. To put first things first, to put that worship of God in front of work instead of after work. Verse 9, "Let more work be laid on the men, that they may labor in it, and let them not regard false words." And the taskmasters of the people and their officers went out and spoke to the people, saying, "Thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go get yourselves straw where you can find it, yet none of your work will be reduced." So the people were scattered abroad throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble instead of straw. So it was an attempt to punish them for asking to go worship God. And it is true that those who come into the truth from the outside or begin to finally follow the truth fully, they get trouble from the outside. Satan strives to throw trouble in front of them to discourage them from doing what they need to do, what God expects them to do. So the taskmasters forced them to hurry, saying, "Fulfill your work, your daily quota, as when there was straw." And the officers of the children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmaster set over them, were beaten and were asked, "Why have you not fulfilled your task in making brick both yesterday and today as before?" Now put yourself in Israel's place. They had just received this grand announcement that they were going to be freed. And their hopes are very high. And the first thing that happens is they get the knees knocked out from under them. They kicked in the shins, we might say. And it's worse. Sometimes there are darker days before the dawn comes. And that's hard. Hard for Christians when dark days come, especially when we expect so much better in the long run. In the long run, of course, is the key. The officers, verse 15, of the children of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, "Why are you dealing this way with your servants? There's no straw given to your servants, and they say to us, 'Make brick.' And indeed, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people." But he said, "You are idle. Idle! Therefore you say, 'Let us go and sacrifice to the Eternal.'" So punishment to try to keep them from worshiping God. "Therefore go now and work," verse 18, "for no straw shall be given you, yet you shall deliver the quota of bricks." And the officers of the children of Israel saw that they were in trouble after it was said, "You shall not reduce any bricks from your daily quota." I'm sure as they walked out of the room, they were saying, "Pharaoh has gone completely insane." And yet they had no way to rectify the situation. Verse 20. "Then as they came out from Pharaoh, they met," you know who, "Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them. And they said to them, "Let the Eternal look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, and put a sword in their hand to kill us." Now, if you were Moses, or if I was Moses, probably at this point we would have said, "See you later. Sayonara. I am out of here. I am not dealing with these people." This is only a small taste of what Moses would now have to endure from that point forward for the next at least 40 years. He'd have to put up with this snotty attitude. Now, when God spoke to Moses and Aaron and to the elders of Israel, what did he tell them? "Over the course of time, I'm going to deliver you. I'm going to have to do lots of miracles." Did they listen to that? No, after the first one, they were discouraged. Now, it shows the difference, I think, between one who has God's Spirit and one who does not. Or at least one in whom it is strong and one whom it may be very weak within. That they had tremendous lack of faith. They didn't believe God. "Moses, I hope God judges you because you've caused us troubles." Verse 22. Now again, what about the snake and the rock and the hand and the miracles? Well, that didn't matter now. Miracles do not convert people. Moses returned to the Eternal and said, "Lord, why have you brought trouble to this people? Why is it you have sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people. Neither have you delivered your people at all." Did Moses fully comprehend how long a process this would be? Apparently not. He would have to learn through it as well. Then down in chapter 6 in verse 1, the Eternal said to Moses, "Now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand he will let them go. And with a strong hand he will drive them out of his land. It's going to come to the point where he'll be so sick of you he can't wait to get rid of you." It would take some time. Quite a bit of time still. Verse 2. Moses, or God spoke to Moses and said, "I am the Eternal. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, Lord or Yahweh, I was not known to them. I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, in which they were strangers." In other words, he's recalling back the promise that he made to Abraham that was passed on to Isaac and then to Jacob and then to the children of Israel, that Canaan would be their land. Verse 5, I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians kept in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. Now again, pause for a second. In the greater scheme of things, God is carrying out this series of events for His honor and glory. Not just because the Israelites needed rescue. God would rescue them, but it clearly was not based on their righteousness. They weren't righteous. They were complaining already. Therefore, verse 6, say to the children of Israel, I am the Eternal. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from their bondage. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. Tell them that. I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. Then you shall know that I, the Eternal, your God, brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will bring you into the land which I swore to give to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. And I will give it to you as a heritage. I am the Eternal. Now, every time we pray to the Eternal, one thing that we're reminded of is we are not. We're not. And when we put ourselves on God's level and we criticize God, it's a dangerous place for us to be spiritually. Verse 9, so Moses spoke thus to the children of Israel. But they did not heed Moses because of anguish of spirit and cruel bondage. Now the word anguish there might also be rendered shortness. Shortness of spirit and cruel bondage. They were impatient. They had a short or anguished spirit because of the difficult circumstances they were under. It is certainly true that their hope was dashed. They did not carefully listen to what God had said. They expected immediate deliverance at that point. After all, they'd been in bondage for a very, very long time, decades and decades, several generations of slavery. They expected God to step in right now. One of the things we learn from this portion of the book of Exodus is God steps in when He chooses. And He's always right. And He's always there at the perfect time. So even though Israel thought it should be sooner, God would step in at the perfect time. He would step in the first month, beginning about the 14th day of that first month, before He would release the people from this trouble. I think verse 9, though, helps us to understand that sometimes anguish of spirit and cruel bondage is very difficult on converted people. It's much more difficult on unconverted people. But when we have a chronic situation, our heart goes out to those individuals because we know how much they must be suffering, how difficult it must be waiting for God to actually step in. And yet God's timing is perfect. He'll do it at the perfect time. Turn over a page to chapter 7. Chapter 7, the rest of the chapter 6 is Moses' genealogy for the most part. Chapter 7 and verse 1, "So the Eternal said to Moses, 'See, I have made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of his land.'" Now again, it's an interesting pause, a complete side change of pace. But Moses never said a word to Pharaoh. It was always through Aaron. Oftentimes, we expect God to give us a word. And God speaks through His prophets. One of the reasons Bible study is so critically important is because this is how God speaks to us. We expect God to answer our prayer right now. God says, "Study my word, you'll understand." So here's God and Aaron, now the prophet. The prophet is the one who speaks for God. So we study the prophet's words, the writers of the Bible, to understand what God is telling us. "So you speak what I command you, and Aaron your brother shall tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of this land," his land. Verse 3, "And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt." In other words, it's going to take multiple judgments, wonders. Verse 4, "Pharaoh will not heed you, so that I may lay my hand on Egypt and bring my armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments." It's going to take many, many miracles. Now, they were never told how many. We all know how many miracles there were. Israel had no idea how many there would have to be before they could leave. Verse 5, "And the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh, the Eternal, when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them." They'll have to recognize the true God. It doesn't say that they'll worship the true God, but they'll have to recognize the true God. Verse 6, "Then Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Eternal had commanded them, so they did. Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron was 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh." So they were elderly gentlemen by our standards. In midlife, though, as far as their standards were concerned, they were middle-aged guys. When you live to 120, 80 is only middle age. So different day, different age, without a doubt. So we go on from there. Let's drop down to verse 22. The first of the plagues begins. Again, put yourselves in the shoes of the Egyptians and then in the shoes of the Israelites. Egyptians, as far as the man on the street, had no idea what was going on. This was all above them. This was a political thing. They may have had some Hebrew slaves. They may not have. But when you're an Israelite and everyone is a slave, this is a critically important juncture in history. Verse 22. After this first plague of changing the Nile to blood and everyone digging wells as best they could somewhere outside of the Nile so that they could get water, it's a tremendously difficult time. Verse 22. The magicians of Egypt did so with their enchantments. With their enchantments. Now, what is fascinating about this, enchantments can be translated secret arts. Somehow, these Egyptian magicians were able to produce water. I should say produce blood from water. Now, whether they had sleight of hand to produce this, or they literally were able to, through demonic help, able to do this, we're not told. Of course, it's an ironic thing that they were able to produce more blood. Like that was helpful. We got a whole Nile full of blood. Could you maybe reverse polarity here? Okay, we know you can make blood. Can you make water? That's really what we need. So what's fascinating is that the miracles of the false teachers were of no real help to the Egyptians. So when Satan produces these kinds of things, there are no real long-term spiritual health at all. Goes on then, the magicians of the Egyptians did exactly the same thing. Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them, just as the Eternal had said. So did God give these Egyptian magicians help to do the same thing, so that Pharaoh's heart would be hardened? And I'm sure as the Nile turns to blood and this carries out exactly the way that Moses and Aaron had proclaimed it, the Israelites would have rejoiced, only to be dashed again. Only to be dashed again. Now, I gather from this as well, when it says, Pharaoh's heart grew hard and he did not heed them as the Eternal had said, and Pharaoh turned and went into his house, neither was his heart moved. It shows that Pharaoh really did not care a lick for his own people. As long as he had water, as long as he was in comfort, it didn't matter what the man on the street was going through. And it's so typical of Satan's approach that he doesn't care about people. Well, he'll care for people so long as it's up to his, or credited to his benefit, does him some good. But beyond that, there's no care for people at all. No care for his own. Second plague takes place in Exodus chapter 8. The plague of the frogs in verse 12. All the frogs come up out of the rivers, out of the swamps, into the houses. They're just overrunning the land. Then verse 12 of chapter 8, Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh. And Moses cried to the Eternal concerning the frogs which he had brought against Pharaoh. So the Eternal did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses, out of the courtyards, out of the fields. And they gathered them together in heaps, and the land stank. Now, I don't know about you, but this second plague always strikes me as a bit, in the midst of all this trouble and challenge, I just see a bit of God's sense of humor. Because Moses goes and says, do you want me to get rid of the frogs? Now, I'm sure Pharaoh had in his mind, yes, please get rid of these frogs. And they all go happily hopping back into the Nile. So God says, okay, I'll get rid of the frogs. And they all drop dead where they are. So you got these piles and piles of rotting, stinking frogs. So to me, that's just a little bit humorous. That Pharaoh, you want these frogs dead? Or you want them gone? Yeah, we'll kill them. So they die all right there. But nonetheless, verse 15, when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart and did not heed them as the Eternal had said. So over and over again. So surely after Pharaoh experiences this problem, the Israelites are excited. Moses and Aaron say, frogs will come, the frogs come. Now we're going to be released. I think as we go through these plagues, we'll see that there's highs and lows in the Israelites' lives. And isn't that a lot like ours? That there are highs and lows. There are times when we've been sick and God has healed us immediately. And there are times when we've been sick and God hasn't healed. Or He's healed partially, or He's healed for a time. And it can be a real trouble, a real challenge to our faith. And that's unfortunately what the Israelites lacked. Beginning in verse 16, the third plague of the lice, the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your rod, strike the dust of the land, so that it may become lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And they did so. For Aaron stretched out his hand with the rod, struck the dust of the earth, it became lice on man and on beast. And the dust of the land became lice throughout all the land of Egypt. Now, if you're like most people, Bugs are okay if they're outside on the plants where they belong. But when they're all over us, one time when our daughter was quite a little girl, she was on a little girl softball team in Texas. We got back in the van after it was dark, the lights had gone off, and we're getting in the car to head home. And a June bug had somehow attached itself to her hair. And she didn't realize it until she got in the car, sitting there in the front seat. And just about everything in the car at that moment became dented because of the just the wildness. We had a little cup holder thing that you put out, you know, you set your coffee cup in. Her foot hit that and smashed it to bits. So for the rest of the time we owned that car, I'd like to, Melissa. But there's something about bugs crawling on you that's just detestable. And in this case, lice just crawling all over them. They couldn't get rid of it. Verse 18. Now the magicians so worked their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they could not. Can you imagine being a magician and being disappointed when you could not produce more lice? Isn't that kind of backward when you think about it? I'm so sorry I couldn't produce more lice for you, Pharaoh. In other words, God was now separating the fact that there are things that only He can do. So He was separating Himself from the gods of Egypt. And didn't He say that He would bring judgment upon all the gods of Egypt? So He couldn't do that with just one plague or two or three. He would take 9 total plagues and then a 10th to completely dismantle the Egyptian religious system. So He's working with all the Egyptians in that sense. He's working with us today. He's working with Moses, working with Pharaoh, working with Aaron, working with Miriam, working with all of Israel, working with the Canaanites, all at the same time on different levels. So when we think our portion of the plan hasn't worked out exactly the way we think it ought to be, remember, God has a much greater plan than me, than us. Ditto for the same 6 plagues to follow. In chapter 8, in verse 30, we have the next plague. Moses went out from Pharaoh and entreated the Eternal. In other words, swarms and swarms of flies. Moses goes out and asks God now to remove them. Because Pharaoh says, go ahead, leave. The Lord did according to the word of Moses. He removed the swarms of flies from Pharaoh and from his servants and from his people. Not one remained. Now you might think, well, flies aren't that big a deal. Or maybe the swarms of some sorts of gnats or insects or things like that. But they can literally drive you mad. I've only been one time in a place where the mosquitoes were so thick that you could hear them buzzing constantly all around, just literally clouds of mosquitoes. Now thankfully we had coverings on, net coverings, so we weren't being bit, but it's just unnerving to have those kinds of swarms. To know that if you lift that veil, you'll be attacked. Just unbelievable. So in verse 32, Pharaoh hardened his heart at this time also. Neither would he let the people go. Satan wants us in bondage and will strive to do all he can to keep us there. The next plague. Moses said, let my people go. If you don't, there's going to be a disease on your cattle. Verse 6. So the Lord did this thing on the next day, and all the livestock of Egypt died. But of the livestock of the children of Israel, not one died. Verse 7. Pharaoh sent, and indeed not even one of the livestock of the Israelites was dead. So now he's just mad. The heart of Pharaoh became hard, and he did not let the people go. Again, put yourself in the shoes of the Israelites. We've got the lice. We've got the flies. We've got the cattle. High as can be, God's going to let us go. And dashed again, Pharaoh says. No, high again, and dropped. Again, one without faith begins to doubt God. And that was Israel's pattern. Because no Holy Spirit, no faith, they trusted no one but themselves. They didn't trust God to actually care for them. Seventh plague, let's drop down to verse 27 here in chapter 9. We've got the hail and the fire. So whether it was literally gasoline-soaked hail balls that burned when they came to the ground, or if we're just talking about this tremendously powerful lightning setting things on fire, plus large hailstones beating things to death. Verse 27, Pharaoh sent and called for Moses and Aaron and said to them, I've sinned this time. Oh, this time? He's in a constant state of sin. But he's, I suppose, saying, I've sinned this time because I haven't let you go the way I promised I would. The Eternal is righteous, and my people and I are wicked. Now remember what Pharaoh said at the very beginning? He said, who is Yahweh that I should let the people go? Now he's calling God's name. Yahweh is righteous. Pharaoh's the one saying that. So the cracks are beginning to show, you might say, in the dike here. The flood is about to pour out. The Lord is righteous, and I and my people are wicked. And I always think it's interesting that Pharaoh says, first of all, God is righteous, and my people and I are wicked. It's not just me, and it's not me first. It's those people, oh yeah, and me too. Again, pride and arrogance is just so overwhelming in this Pharaoh. And what is God teaching us? That pride and arrogance is the downfall, was the downfall of Lucifer. And it will be the downfall of us as well if we don't take on that attitude of humility that God expects from us. So verse 28, entreat the Eternal, so he's using his name again, that there may be no more mighty thundering and hail, for it is enough. I will let you go, and you shall stay no longer. No longer. So Moses said to him, as soon as I have gone out of the city, I will spread out my hands to the Eternal. The thunder will cease and there will be no more hail, that you may know that the earth is the Eternal's. That's a concept that the pagans didn't understand. All of their gods had regional responsibilities. Moses is telling him, no, there's a supreme creator God that controls the whole earth. Now it's interesting that in verse 30, but as for you and your servants, I know that you will not yet fear the Eternal God. Moses could still sense that he was just trying to save his own skin in that sense. Verse 34, when Pharaoh saw that the rain, the hail, and the thunder had ceased, he sinned yet more. He hardened his heart, he and his servants. So the heart of Pharaoh was hard. Neither would he let the children of Israel go as the Eternal had spoken by Moses. And again, put yourself in the Israelites' shoes. This tremendous destruction coming upon the Egyptians. We're going to be released for sure this time, and it still doesn't happen. Can you imagine that some in Israel might question, well, God, what are you doing? Why aren't you fixing my circumstance? And yet what was most important to God was not their particular circumstance. Well, as part of it, God was very concerned for them, loved them, no doubt. But he knew when he would release them. In chapter 10, we have the eighth plague. Drop down to verse 16. Locusts swarm all over the land. They eat everything that's left from the barley and the flax that would have been destroyed earlier. Verse 16. Pharaoh calls for Moses and Aaron in haste and said, I have sinned against Yahweh, your God, and against you. Now, therefore, please forgive my sin only this once. I don't know why Pharaoh said it that way, but the sense I get from that is, you know, this time I recognize that I might have made a mistake. I have this once, just this once, I've sinned. That's the sense I get from that. Forgive my sin only this once, or maybe he's saying finally, and entreat the eternal God that he may take away from me this death only. So he went out from Pharaoh and entreated the Eternal. He asks God to step in. And the Eternal turned a very strong west wind, which took the locusts away and blew them into the Red Sea. There remained not one locust in all the territory of Egypt. But, verse 20, the Eternal hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the children of Israel go. I've often wondered how God hardened his heart. I'm not necessarily a big fan of Cecil B. DeMille and his version of the Exodus. But one intriguing thing I thought he always had in that program was Nefertiti, Pharaoh's wife, and how she was an instrument, at least in the way that he portrayed it in the Hollywood version, that she would start to speak from him, oh, you are so weak. Would the great Pharaoh of all Egypt let a Hebrew slave? And she would go on like this. Is that how God hardened Pharaoh's heart? Maybe. Maybe it was an advisor. Maybe it was his own pride. We're not told. The ninth plague comes in chapter 10 here in verse 21. The Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, darkness which may even be felt. And you have a small taste of that you know when it's dark and stormy, and then there's just that feel of darkness, that this is abnormal, this is not right. If you've ever been near a tornado, you get that kind of greenish gray sky that's just roiling and boiling, and something is not right about this. So this darkness is just palpable. Thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. They didn't see the sun for 3 full days. God now striking out at the premier god of Egypt, the god of the sun, Amun-Ra. Verse 23, they did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days. But all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. Again, a tremendous miracle. Impossible of and by itself without God's direct intervention. So Pharaoh calls for Moses and says, get out of here. Leave. It's time for you to go. But verse 27, the Eternal hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let them go. Pharaoh said to him, get away from me. Take heed to yourself and see my face no more, for in the day you see my face, you shall die. So Moses said, you have spoken well. I will never see your face again. So it was time to leave. And yet, it wasn't enough. In chapter 11, verse 1, the Eternal said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. Now, up to this point, they had no idea how many more plagues would come, how many times their hopes would be up and then not fulfilled. But one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. Afterward, he will let you go from here. And when he lets you go, he will surely drive you out of here altogether. He will want you out very, very badly. So the death of the firstborn is announced. Verse 2. Speak now in the hearing of the people. Let every man ask from his neighbor and every woman from her neighbor articles of silver and articles of gold. They're going to now require payment for the decades, in fact, the generations of slavery and working for free that they had been through. The Eternal gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man, Moses, was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, in the sight of the people. Moses said, "Thus says the Eternal, about midnight I will go out into the land of Egypt, midst of Egypt. And all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the female servant who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the animals." I want you to pause there for a second. There are quite a number of individuals who feel that they could never serve this God because they'll take things like this and they'll say, "Could you possibly serve a God who murders little children like this one did?" You know, atheists are real fond of quoting things like this to say, "See, how could you possibly think this is a God you would worship when it's murder after murder after murder?" Well, you have to pause for a second. First of all, as we often told our students, the same thing that Christ told the Pharisees applies in almost every case of religious ignorance. And that is, Christ told the Pharisees that you err, number one, not knowing the Scriptures. You don't know what the Bible says, nor the power of God. You don't have the Holy Spirit. You don't know the power of God. You don't know what God is capable of, what He's able to do. So that's the case here. Oh, you have all these children dying. What about what's happened previously? This is God giving them what they had already given to the Israelites. What were those firstborn babies, those baby boys, supposed to have done to them? They were supposed to be slit, sliced, killed, drowned immediately. And when that didn't happen, they were supposed to be tossed into the Nile, drowned. And hundreds, maybe thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of babies were murdered, slaughtered. So was this a righteous judgment on God's behalf? Absolutely it was. Absolutely a righteous judgment. Now, we know all those babies will be resurrected. And they'll be given an opportunity to live and to understand why they died. They'll have no recollection of this, of course. But they'll be able to be taught and receive a beneficial lesson and hopefully receive eternal life as a result of what they've experienced. So don't go telling me God is unfair, that this God is just a murderer. It's just not true. God has control and power over all life and death, and whatever He chooses to do is right and is righteous. And in this case, He was going to give to the Egyptians what they had given to the Israelites. To help them understand, you just cannot treat other human beings this way. And as we've often said, the carnal mind only understands, it seems, superior force. The carnal mind does not understand reason. When emotion gets involved, the carnal mind simply cannot reason. I've told you before, growing up, one of the lessons my father taught me in the bar was never try to reason with a drunk. Because they can't reason. They cannot reason. So don't try to say, "Well, look, you're just being a little out of control here." And they're going to stop and say, "You know what? You're absolutely right." Doesn't happen. Cannot reason. So in this case, they were going to receive what they had apparently very gladly done to the Israelites in the past. From the firstborn of the female servant, middle of verse 5, who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the animals. Verse 6, there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as was not like it before, nor shall be like it again. But against none of the children of Israel shall a dog even wag its tongue or bark. Against a man or beast, that you may know that the Eternal does make a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. God has complete and total control. Verse 8, and all these your servants shall come down to me and bow down to me, saying, "Get out, and all the people who follow you." After that, I will go out. Then he went out from Pharaoh in great anger. But the Eternal said to Moses, Pharaoh will not heed you, so that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt. So Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, and the Eternal hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the children of Israel go out of his land. So at this point, the only thing that will release Israel from Egypt is the death of the firstborn. Isn't it sad that the carnal mind is so stubborn and resistant to God's Spirit that it takes something like this to turn their hearts, to want them to go? Now, I would imagine that many of the common Egyptians already were wanting the Israelites to go, but the stubbornness of the Pharaoh withheld that. So at this point, we have the instruction regarding the Passover. So what we want to emphasize up to this point is that living as an Egyptian was a difficult trial at this point because of miserable, wicked leadership. Now, Israelites or Egyptians had their part as well. But wicked, miserable leadership brings heartache upon people. No wonder we pray each day for God's kingdom to come, so that wicked, miserable leadership will be removed. Spirit beings will be placed in those positions of leadership so that they can bring righteousness to the people. No wonder the proverb says, when the righteous rule, there's great happiness among the people, in essence, to paraphrase. And we understand the Israelites are in a situation of highs and lows, incredible highs, incredible hope, only to be dashed. And now their hope is building one last time, and it will be rewarded. So, brethren, our lesson, obviously, is to trust God regardless of the physical circumstances. He knows what He's doing. He intervenes at the perfect time. If He chooses not to intervene, as He had for the previous 80 years, it's for good purpose. He knows what He's doing. He has our best interests at heart. So we'll pick it up next time with the introduction of the Passover.